Well, brothers and sisters in the Dharma, and dear friends, this is the last FWBO day, because in 6 weeks' time, we will be the Triratna Buddhist community. In short, Triratna and not TBC. And the change of the name is not just for convenience, even if it grew out of convenience. The name change came because the order members in India really wanted the same name as we have. And they, when they started, even they could call themselves Western Buddhists. So they invented something. But after 20 years' time, the Sangharakshita has decided to have the same name for the whole within the whole of the movement and the whole of the order. And that's important also, not just for India, because the interest in Buddhism and especially in our movement is growing very, very fast at places all over the world. For instance, in Russia, you can call yourself a Western Buddhist, or contacts in Singapore or East Asia don't have no use for being Western Buddhists and so. So that's the convenience. But this name change happened at a point in history where we can see that the mentality is changing fast and may be changing fundamentally in some respects. The 21st century will be very different from the 20th century. And it is in the 20th century that the FWBO was founded and grew into an important Buddhist movement. But Buddhist movements are part of samsara. And we all know that the fundamental law of samsara is that things will come about under conditions. And the FWBO, as it was, is part of those conditions of the age in which it, it came into being. It was an age which was really very favorable for starting that kind of activities. But it had also its limits on the influence the movement could have on society. I will go into that more deeply immediately. But the Triratna Buddhist movement or community will have to operate in conditions which are in important aspects quite different from the ones of, say, 40 years ago. And this makes that some of the success formulas of the FWBO are no longer applicable because the conditions under which they worked are no longer there. But that's what I will try to look into for today. What were the conditions under which the FWBO grew? What are the conditions today? And what are the consequences for what we can do and what we have to do, really? And I will look under this under four headings. First, I will give a very rough sketch of what happened in the 20th century and the beginnings of the 21st century. Then I will look into the conditions in which the FWBO grew in the 20th century. And then the most important part of today is what I see as the task of the Triratna Buddhist community now at the beginning of the 21st century. And most important of all, my last point is the most important teaching of Sangharakshita to guide us in what we have to do in the future. So first, a very rough sketch of what happened in the 20th century. Big changes in history don't follow always very neatly the decades we have in our calendars. In fact, mentally speaking, the 20th century started in August 1914, with the beginning of what we call the World War I. The first years of that century essentially still belong to the 19th century, which was the unfolding of the industrial age, at first the profits only for the rich, but with workers living in appalling conditions. But by the end of that period, the life standards had improved quite a lot already for everyone. And there was a growing optimism in the potentialities of industry and the potentialities of science. But First World War showed the negative sides of those potentialities. It showed how industry and science could destroy lives in a scale, on a scale which had never been possible before. It started with a massive destruction, and this massive destruction is the real beginning of the of what we know as the 20th century, in which we can distinguish three periods. Well, first, the glum start, of course, with the war and with a period of deep instability, old empires disappearing, communism in Russia, fascism elsewhere, an economic depression which lasted for 10 years, and all ending with another war, which was even more destructive than the one 20 years before. And then, after the Second World War, started the 20th century as we have lived it. I was born during that war. I haven't lived worst of it. And after the war, we come into a period of a kind of explosion, almost of affluence. The production exploded, stimulated by a new economic policy, but that's not important maybe. But the consequence of it was a welfare state came into being, with even people living on benefit were much better off, say, than King Louis XIV of France 2 centuries before. And there was the optimistic mood of those times. There is enough for everyone, and even too much for everyone. That was already the feeling our generation, when we were 20, had, say, in the 60s. And that period ended in overstimulation of the economy, leading to inflation, undercut by an oil crisis. And what happened then is what you could term the a kind of revolution of the rich. The people who had money well saw their money disappearing under inflation, and a new, completely new economic policy came into being, an economic policy which installed what I would call market fundamentalism, a belief that the market was a miraculous instrument to solve all problems of society, and if you let the market go its way, everything would be a bright future. But what happened, in fact, of course, was that massive delocalization of production, people losing jobs, the income distribution becoming more and more in favor of those who had the money already, isolating people, young people in who were finding it difficult to find a job and that kind of stuff. And that period ended very recently. The 21st century, I think I can date on, I think, the 7th of September, 2 years ago, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. Because the end of this revolution of the rich was that money had been cut loose completely from production. Money was rushing around the world without any notable benefit, money creating money, but this was just a huge bubble which was building up. A lot of money the banks had on their books was just a bubble, was nothing. And when the bubble burst, well, they had the problems we have seen now, but they had to write off bubble money which had never had any real existence anywhere. So, but the problem is that ended, how would I call it, the last bit of optimism that, being rich, that we had things under control. And it has not led to a real big crisis, but it has led to a marked change in mentality, of which I will speak more a bit later on. So just in a few minutes' time, the whole of the history of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. It's important because it gives the conditions under which, according to the laws of samsara, we have to operate. And so let's look at the FWBO then. I have styled that Living the Dharma in the 20th Century. And that history starts in 1966 when an English Buddhist monk his name was still in Pali, Mahathera Sangharakshita, who had lived and practiced in India since the end of the war, was invited to London by the tiny English Buddhist community of the time, very tiny. It was just a couple of groups. And he had been called to deal with a strong disagreement between the two groups in that scene. One group, which you could call with a bit of a Theravadist fundamentalist leaning, real Buddhism was having the real monk and that kind of stuff. And then the other one was an intellectual, what Sangharakshita has termed in armchair Buddhist club, but which was dimly looking for contemporary Buddhism. And Sangharakshita was acceptable to both sides because at one side he was a very seriously practicing Theravadin monk, but to the second he was known already as someone of high intellectual standards, and he had written, for instance, a basic work as a survey of Buddhism. Now, London 1966 was a very different place from his city of birth. He had left at the end of the war. And that were the high days of the of the affluence I just spoke about. It was very different from the agrarian artisanal societies also in which Buddhism had arose and had developed, and in which Sangharakshita had been practicing. Sangharakshita was mainly, when he was practicing in India, he was back in the Middle Ages, so to speak. And then he came from the Middle Ages to the big city of London, where people were living in affluence, and very important also, where traditional attitudes to religion were largely dead and gone. That's something which is true for our time still, of course. And he saw at once the thirst for the Dharma, but also he saw the necessity of translating the Dharma to the West in its new setting, in two aspects. One, the expression of it, how you put it into words, translating the Dharma into Western ways of thinking. And he had already done a great deal of that in writing the Survey of Buddhism and quite a few articles in several periodicals. But more important, he discovered that it needed translation in lifestyle also. The full-timer in the East was the monk, with rules developed in an agrarian society, and they turned out, in his experience, to be more of a hindrance to bring the Dharma to the West than a help. And he acted on it. At the level of expression, the Dharma, he gave a tremendous series of lectures. Some of them are still fundamental to our way of studying the Dharma. For instance, Vision and Transformation, which is about the very basis of our vision of the Dharma, was the result of a series of talks he gave in those times before the FWBO came into being. Gradually also he stopped acting to be a monk, and up to the point that he became unacceptable to the Theravada side of the people he had around him. And he was dismissed as resident monk from the Vihara where he was living. And what would most people do then? Well, he had a choice. He could go back to Kalimpong, where he had been living comfortably, where he had a very high social status. They started calling him Rinpoche, the Tibetans. Rinpoche is the title you give to a tulku, to one who is the rebirth of a very important lama before him. But he chose to stay in complete insecurity, the complete insecurity of the brick and concrete desert of London, so to speak, with just a few people around him who dimly had an idea of what he wanted to do, very dimly. And they became the friends of a Western Buddhist order he intended to found. And while I was preparing this, I just started noticing that how extraordinary that really is, because he happened to do that at the very point in history where it was possible, where there was kind of a window of opportunity, 10 years or so, in which it could have happened. If he had started 10 years earlier, he would have been preaching in the desert. He wouldn't have found anyone who would listen to him. If he had started 10 years later, well, the optimistic mood of the times of the end of the 60s would have gone. We would have had the oil crisis already, the first stagflation and all the kind of economical problems which were mounting. And the people wouldn't have found anymore the young people who were with whom he started his actions. But at that very window in time, he found a group of young people mainly, who were still living in that mood of affluence. There is enough for every one of us. We are even taking far more than we need. Who believed in the possibilities of making a better world. The expressions were, well, the hippie movement, a movement for authentic socialism. I have been involved in for very deeply myself. People thinking about ecological living, it was all started in those days. And 10 years later, the mood was changing, was fast changing already into the me mood. But he started just in time a kind of self-contained network of institutions for full-time practice, which was called the New Society. New Society with basically, of course, Buddhist centers, but also communities, living into communities, and the beginnings of right livelihood businesses. And this was solidly established by the time the mood of the time had changed. And it, how would I say, it was still fed by people coming along, but mainly people who had still that mood. Take myself as an example. If I had been in 64, in 67 in London, I might have got involved. But I discovered it only 20 years later, after I had discovered that authentic socialism wasn't working at all. And I have the impression, when I look around, that quite a number of people who drifted later on into our centers were in fact basically people of my generation and with that kind of mood. That meant, of course, that both the order grew older, and that also the people coming new to the centers grew older also. And very recently, the whole of this movement, and especially the order, has gone through a deep crisis, a crisis of confidence. Mainly with the people who were deeply involved in that new society. We have seen far less of that on the continent, of course. I think mainly because most of those institutions didn't take root with us. But it has led to the implosion of quite a few important things. Communities have almost disappeared. Hardly any, leading order member still living in a community, for instance. And later on, and a bit more slowly, also the right livelihood businesses have or disappeared or have transformed into more commercial settings. And there may be doubtless lots of personal reasons why people have left the old setting. But I think when you look beyond the events which triggered the crisis, then I think you can see the crisis was unavoidable because the conditions under which that whole system had grown were no longer there. And when they are no longer there, according to the law of Pratitya Samutpada, the institutions disappear also. And I would say that this crisis was the equivalent for us of the banking crisis in the society in general. And that this crisis has just kicked us into the 21st century. But we were better off than the banks because our core business has survived. our core business is practicing the Dharma, together, practicing in such a way that other people can join us, and that the centers of Buddhist practice have stayed alive, the urban centers, but also the retreat centers. They went through, not always very easy times, but they survived, and they survived quite well. And this points out where to start in this 21st century. And that's what the third part of my talk then, the Triratna Buddhist movement and the 21st century. And one very striking thing is that this 21st century, we started on the 7th of September, what year was that, 2008, has already a significant change in the workings of our centers. Over the last 2 years, the numbers have gone up of new people coming along, not just a bit, but very strongly. Doubling in Paris, they have even a waiting list now for people who want really to come to the center, but there is simply no room for it and not enough people to teach the Dharma. It's not that dramatic everywhere, but it's noticeable. And the second thing noticeable also is that it's largely another generation coming along. It's no longer the left outs of the hippie revolution or the Marxist revolution of 68. You are one also, yes. But it's also not the very young people with hardly any experience of life, as it was in the early days. In the early days, Sangharakshita started with really a lot of very young and sometimes very, still teenage-like people from the stories I hear. But it's also no longer people in their 50s or even older who have full experience of life. Now, a younger generation seems to come along. Who were lucky enough didn't need all those years to find out life is not working as you would want it. To discover that something essential is lacking in life. And thus numbers and generation change is not just a phenomenon of our centers. When I hear around in the Belgian Buddhist Union from other centers, they have everywhere the same phenomenon. More people coming to classes and to generally the average age much lower than it used to be a couple of years ago. And this again is not just accidental. I think it's connected with a general change of attitude towards Buddhism in society generally. In the 60s, Buddhism was an obscure, foreign, oriental region of which people knew hardly anything at all. It was very hard to find something about it. When I started looking for it in 86, that was, I had to go to an English bookshop in Brussels to find a book on Buddhism in a bookshop, just to give one indication. Especially in English, Buddhist books are printed by... not by the hundreds maybe, but at least 20 or so a year. And even in Dutch, publishing books about Buddhism is really thriving. So society, it has become something different from what it was in the mind of people. Something people can see as relevant to their own lives. And two aspects stand out of it, what they see as relevant. It's first Buddhism as a non-violent way of life, approach of life. And the second thing they are looking for is meditative calm, quietness in their life. One indication, for instance, of the influence of Buddhism is, if I just look in Belgium, a couple of years ago, the Dalai Lama was around here and he attracted a crowd of about 10,000 people in the Sportpaleis in Antwerpen. If he had come 10 years before, he might have had a few hundreds. And if he had come 20 years before, probably hardly anyone would have noticed he was here. So what I see is that a new window of opportunity has opened already. How long it will last, I can't foretell, of course. Foretelling the future is about the most dangerous thing you can do. But at least it's clear that window of opportunity is there and it is open. A window of opportunity to take on what Bhante Sangharakshita has set out. Well, to take the title of the book Subhuti wrote about him, Bringing Buddhism to the West. And also to realize our Bodhisattva ideal in action. And to see what we do, I think we have to look two ways. We have to do a look back in the experience of the 20th century FWBO, not to copy recipes of the past. They won't work because the conditions are not there anymore. But to make sure we guard the fundamentals of the vision and keep up the inspiration. And then the other way of looking, we have to look ahead in the 21st century to see what are the new opportunities arising and to find new expressions for our Buddhist ideal. And if we look first then into the back, into our past, one can wonder why the FWBO did not only stay alive but even grow, even when the conditions became more and more adverse. Well, the fundamental reason, of course, is because it was really solidly rooted in the Dharma, in the way its founder, Sangharakshita, was himself also. I put it that way, living according to the Dharma, nothing but the Dharma and all of it. So that means not its trappings, not its externalities, not the cultural externalities, but really the core of the Dharma at the core of one's life. Live to its full and in all its important aspects. That's something I find striking when I come in contact with other Buddhist groups also. They tend to specialize in one of the important things in Buddhism. But what Sangharakshita set out to do was a Buddhist movement where all of the important elements were brought together in a balance. Ethical living, I know no other movement where it is pointed out so systematically from the very beginning and all the way through as in our movement. Working on mental states in meditation. Meditating is you find everywhere, of course, but that it is working with mental states is something I never heard before, or I hardly hear anywhere else. And that will come back at the end of my talk. And then, of course, leaving behind unhelpful views and developed wisdom is the third one. And that's the very thing Sangharakshita has stressed from the beginning. You need to do all of it. You can't pick out something you like the most. You have to practice the whole of it. And you have people who make it central to their lives. And that was the order he wanted to found, and he found it. Looking for people who were really full-time Buddhists. The same as the monks of the older traditions, but without taking the externalities of a monk. He used the formula not monk, but not no monk, a formula which comes from Shinran, the founder of the Pure Land tradition. And that's what more order members are. They are not monks in the sense or what we are meant to be anyway. What we make out of it is maybe another question. But that's what we try to do anyway, living with the same intensity as a monk, but without taking the externalities of being a monk. And he just didn't leave it to just to order members. It's also something which is very deep into our culture, that practicing is the important thing. So we have mitras and friends who often practice at the same intensity, or at least have the Dharma as important elements in their lives. Not just tacked to it, for a couple of hours a week, the equivalent of going on Mass on Sunday and then going on with business as usual. The very insistence of Sangharakshita has been that our movement is a movement of people who take the Dharma seriously and who take it serious in their lives. So this is the standard set up for us, and we cannot go. We have to not just to keep it up, but we have to take it on a higher level. That's another important teaching I have from Sangharakshita. As long as we are not stream entrants, we cannot sit back and enjoy the level we have attained. Because, well, life, spiritual life, as long as we are not stream entrants, is like an escalator going down. Well, when you are at the top of it and you do nothing, well, you just go down. And you have to keep moving, at least not to go down. And if you want to go up, you have to keep moving even faster. So, standing still is sliding back. That's and Sangharakshita added to it, it's not enough to stay on the same level. You really have to get further and further. And once a couple of times he must have said that the highest praise for a teacher, who is not a Buddha himself, of course, is that he has disciples who surpasses him. So what he asks us is to surpass him. That's fundamentally our task, to practice on a higher level than the one which has been built up over the past 43 years, to a higher level even than Sangharakshita, if we can manage. But that's the task we have, and that's something we take from the past. And of course, this will take us busy for quite some time. Probably even beyond this 21st century, but let's do what we can within this life and this century anyway. One consequence of it is we will need to create intensive situations and I would even say perhaps even a monastic wing to replace the semi-monastic setting of the communities and so on, which are no longer. Or at least creating opportunities for immersion in that kind of setting for from time to time. So I think that's a task for our retreat centers. They just not organize retreats for the standard retreats we do, but think of having a kind of retreats, longer. Longer intensive retreats, and some of us trying to go there. But then I'm already started looking ahead into the future. I will not venture to speculate what will happen, that's far too risky. But I will look into a couple of things which needs to be done when we look at the present set of conditions. We know by now people need us and our experience. And when we put our bodhisattva idea really into practice, we will have to create an attitude of opening up to the needs of people. It will be on basis, of course, of our practice, which we will have to keep on deepening. But from a new perspective. I think we will need a new perspective in this 21st century. Not just concentrating on me and my practice. And that's something which is in all of us. And that's something which also is a bit in the culture of the FWBO. We have the Bodhisattva ideal as an ideal. But it's not, for many of us, not very much part of our spiritual life itself. In fact, it means going largely beyond the inward-turning attitude the FWBO had. And that's no criticism to the past. That inward-turning attitude was absolutely necessary for starting a new movement and for building it up. It was necessary in its formative phase, because, well, Sangharakshita started with a lot of inexperienced people with no model whatsoever from traditional Buddhism. And they had to develop something, intensifying their practice, and there was no outside help that they could use. So they turned inwardly and they built a movement which was very much turned on itself and kept aloof from the rest of the Buddhist world. And also it had one tendency of concentrating only on people who were ready to take the spiritual life much further. There have many thousands of people have come through the doors of our centers who were not up to that. They saw something in Buddhism, they had some connection with its values, but they were not ready to, how would you call it, to give it a really important place into their lives. But they still had the need of staying into contact with the Dharma. And I think that's something for the future to look into. The need of opening up our centers or or having activities elsewhere, it doesn't matter, for what you could call supporters. For what, well, I will not explain the term for those who don't know it, but for what Sangharakshita called ethnic Buddhists. That's people who share our values, but who are not up to our intensive practice. And up to now we have not provided for them. They came along for a couple of months, for some time, and then disappeared again. It was unavoidable in the first years, but I think it's really important for us to think it over, what we can do to, what we can offer to those people who share our values, but are not up to going on in intensifying their practice. This would be an important service to, well, many thousands of people who are open to just that. And secondly, it is essential to build a large support network for Buddhism in society generally. Something Vante also stressed as necessary in the long term for any Buddhist movement. And this is very important. This is no plea to water down our activities to the level of those people. That's the very last thing we really should do. It should be intensified. But we would have to add something. And what and how, I simply don't see. I know from myself, I have not the temperament to start that kind of activities myself. But I think we will have to experiment that way. We have no models available. And I see another important area of opening up in contacts with other Buddhist associations. Also in that respect, the FWBO had a very inward-turned attitude, and there were very sound and solid reasons for that also. For a start, when Sangharakshita started, there was not very much Buddhism around, and a lot of it was of really very doubtful quality. Also, as he always has stressed, you cannot practice in three different traditions at the same time. You have to choose to get a set of practices and to stick to that if you want to get any further. But again, I think in this respect we are far more adult than we used to be, and we are ready not just to meet the others, but to share our practice of our experience of practicing as Western Buddhists. And I'm speaking from experience here. Our contacts in the Belgian Buddhist Union show there is a deep interest for what we are doing from other more traditional Buddhist movements, even the most traditional Tibetan group in Belgium. Well, people, the leading people from it are really fascinated by what we are doing. But again, this doesn't mean a plea for making a kind of melting pot. All we have to do is not to keep aloof anymore. And I think we have a very good example, something to show to others. As I mentioned already, most other traditions tend to focus on one aspect of practice. And we have a balanced and coherent set of practices, spanning the whole field of Buddhist practice. And we may occasionally learn something from specialists, for instance. Well, if you want to go for an intensive course on, say, mindfulness, maybe a retreat with the teaching at hand people can help us a bit. But we can offer also something to those specialists, and quite a bit even. And I think it's important to well, not to have any feelings of inferiority, nor compensating them by saying we are the best. Although we are the best, of course, but but taking to heart the advice the Buddha must have given hundreds of times, the wise has no need of comparing. He doesn't bother whether he is better or worse or equal to others. He simply doesn't compare. And another thing I wanted to mention, but time is running out, I just mention it, is new initiatives of working in society. And I'm thinking of Breathworks, which is in this Ghent center anywhere, how would I call it, inflaming almost every active member in the Sangha. But that's for another occasion. For a conclusion, I want to point out the most important teaching of Sangharakshita to guide us. It's mine also, in my life, the most important teaching, and I think it's a mind guideline for all of us. And it's what the world needs most also. And that is, spiritual life is not about fighting negative mental states or avoiding sin or mental states. It's about developing positive mental states. Negative mental states are just wrongly directed emotional energy. And spiritual life consists basically in redirecting that energy to developing positive mental states. And the foundation stone of this is, well, a word we all know, is metta. And again, that is something which is very distinctive for the FWBO. Metta is mentioned elsewhere also, but nowhere I have found it into such a central and prominent place as within our movement. And this metta, loving kindness, a universal attitude of positivity, of benevolence, of friendliness, of love to oneself and to all other beings, or I would say to all beings, including oneself, is the cornerstone of our practice, really. And this metta is not something we have laboriously to create in meditation. It's something which is already present in our mind. Even if at times it's covered by thick layers of negativity, but metta is not something we have to invent. It's something which is very really already present in our minds. And all we have to do is to direct all that negativity on top of it in a way that metta can come forward, can grow, and can become bigger and bigger. And the simple, basic means for this is letting go of the grasping ego. Whenever we let go of me wanting this for me, this me as absolute point of reference in the whole universe, when we open up to our relationship to others, to the whole universe even, well, when we open up that to this reality and let go of me grasping, then metta is just the automatic result of it. Just comes up and becomes stronger and stronger. And as I said already, it is absolutely central to our teachings, thanks to the teaching of Sangharakshita. It's the root attitude of our movement, if not necessarily the basic, the root practice of every one of us. And we are beginning to see that metta is not just something preparatory to the real thing, to enlightenment. Metta is the royal highway to liberation, is the royal highway to enlightenment. And this is what we have to offer to a world who has lost all its perspective. The world, at least here in the West, people are no longer believing in God. nor are they any longer believing in infinite progress from science and technology. And, well, the only things left are grabbing and cynicism. They are really, just look around you. They are all around us as the basic attitude in our society. But we see also, well, number of people coming newly to our centers, that there are people who are looking for more, that there are people looking for much better. And that, I think, is the task of this, Triratna Buddhist community, to open up to the needs of the world. We can identify that way. And to put our main, our basic fundamental attitude at the disposition of everyone. And then we are not inventing something. Then we are just guided by the words the Buddha spoke to his first bhikkhus, his first full-time practitioners, when he sent them, to go and walk around, to live the life of errant monks. I will cite it in Pali. It's for me also one of the central inspirations of my life. Charatha bhikkhave charitam bahujana hitaya bahujana sukhaya lokanukampaya athaya hitaya sukhaya deva manusanam. Go then, practitioners, and lead a life for the good of the manifold, for the happiness of the manifold, for compassion with the world, for the well-being, the good, and the happiness of heavenly and human beings. So that is what we have to do, and let's go for it.